Rob Lowe got his start in show business when he was 15 years old with a role in Francis Ford Coppola's The Outsiders. Despite some difficulties over the years, he has maintained his acting career and built a respectable public image that today has everyone from teens to grandmothers admiring him for several reasons. His new autobiography, Stories I Only Tell My Friends, is published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Rob Lowe to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you call this an autobiography and not a memoir. Did you consider the implications of each label?
No, actually, that's the first anyone has called it an autobiography on this little press tour. But
it says it right on the book.
Does it say
an autobiography?
Well, you know, I should probably look at my own cover. I'm going to do that. That tells you how busy I've been. finding there's so many different ways to go into your own life, right? I mean, I thought about doing a sort of collection of essays, which is one way to do it. I thought about doing it very sort of, anecdotally. And I think autobiography at the end of the day seems a little, I don't know, a memoir seems very fancy, doesn't it?
No, I think it's the other way around, but
oh, really?
It's
okay.
Your title is The Stories I Only Tell My Friends. So yeah. Is that the way it is? Are these the stories you used to tell your closest friends?
They are. And, you know, when my kids finally read the book, their reaction, I think, was really telling. And it made me feel like I accomplished what I wanted to, because they said, gee, Dad, I mean, first of all, it just sounds like you talking. And I've heard all these stories 1,000 times. So they really are stories that I share with my closest friends.
All of these stories you told your kids?
Not all of them.
were you concerned when they did get to read the book? How old are your sons?
17 and 15.
Well, old enough now.
They're not only are they old enough, they're the exact ages I was when I started my really public journey. And so just to even look at my own children and to think about them going through what I was about to go through is one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Are they going to go into acting?
I don't think so.
You and your brother, that was enough?
That was an endless, and it's been great. If they wanted to, I would completely sign off on it. But it looks like one of them is going to be working on Capitol Hill this summer. I won't be a stage father in show business, but I'll make Joe Kennedy look like a shrinking violet if they go into politics.
Well, the West Wing connection, right?
Yeah, no, it's exactly. It's in our blood.
Does living in Hollywood from an early age have an effect on someone's sense of reality?
I think so, because, I mean, just, you know, and it's funny, I write about this in the early chapters about the first blush of being famous. For me, I was 15 and I was still at high school. I was at Santa Monica High School. I was a theater nerd.
But there were other kids who were also having careers.
Not yet.
Careers.
No, they all came after me. So, I mean, in Santa Monica High School, I was the only one who had a career of note. In fact, in those days, I mean, you have to really go back and remember there was no Nickelodeon, MTV, USA Today. None of that sort of celebration of youth culture was really in its infancy. So it was pre-Glee. You know, if you were into theater and that, you were sort of a fruitcake. So I was not popular with the girls. And then overnight, with a little bit of fame, it all changes. And that's a weird scene.
But you'd moved to Southern California to get into show business, hadn't you?
No, my mom divorced. My mom and dad divorced, and she happened to remarry a guy who worked in Southern California.
So you went from Dayton, Ohio, to Southern California. Well, that must have been a culture shock for you.
That was a culture shock for sure. I mean, that was. Listen, in Ohio in the summers, you wore your jeans, even if it was 80 degrees, because people who wore shorts were pansies. And then I show up in Malibu in my jeans and I'm like, hey, get off the beach, Fonzie.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you can go either way in Southern California, anywhere else.
Yeah.
You said that you were a theater nerd, so you'd always wanted to be an actor?
Yeah, from the time I was 8, it was just something that I was passionate about. And, you know, I was one of those kids who was blessed to have a dream. And that's one of the themes of the book for me, is the sort of blessing and sometimes a little bit of a curse of being a very young child and having a sense of where that you want to go with your life.
Because there are a lot of people who are child stars who then complain that they missed an awful lot.
Right.
Some actually hated their parents because they were pushed into show business. That's not your problem.
No, mine was the opposite. My parents were supportive, but you know, I was often taking a bus, you know, sometimes 60 miles one way for an audition that might last 45 seconds and then doing my homework back on the bus and going to school. So, you know, this was something I really, really sort of wanted, and I don't even know why.
And what was your first breakthrough role?
I think probably, well, when I was 15, I got cast in a big television series on ABC called A New Kind of Family. Mm-hmm. It was opposite 60 Minutes, which made us the lowest rated show on the network television schedule, and we lasted about 6 episodes. But it put me on the map and really started off my career, really.
But then you write, I didn't know it yet, but I will come to learn that being charged on the African savannah by a rhino is only fractionally more dangerous than being bull rushed by a gang of 14-year-old girls whipped into a lather by hormones, groupthink, and an overdose of Tiger Beat magazine.
Yes.
When did it change, and was it a kind of an overnight thing?
It was literally overnight. We recorded one show in front of, we did all of our shows in front of a live audience on this sitcom. One week, it was, you know, I'd get some applause and laughs, and it was all great. Then the first show aired. And that week, when the audience came in, when I walked out, they went ballistic. And it was such a powerful sort of indictment on the power of television. In 1 week, you know, it was my life was changed. That's how powerful TV is.
And you couldn't have been prepared.
No, was not. I was 15, and at school, I was still the acting nerd in the corner that the girls and popular guys ignored because I didn't play football and I wasn't a volleyball player.
Yeah, but you were a good-looking guy, and you write later, you say, some years later, you say, there's just no way anyone is likely to take a 19-year-old boy as pretty as I was seriously.
Right, exactly. I mean, I look back on my early stuff and I go, geez Louise, you know, I mean, I didn't feel on the inside like I looked on the outside.
Well, that's a problem for anyone who's really, really good looking, who knows that he or she is getting all sorts of special treatment for no reason other than their bone structure and, you know, the color of their hair, the quality of their skin.
Yeah. And it cuts both ways too. You know, I think over the course of my life, it's sort of been a push. It's gotten me a lot of things. It certainly early in my career, it helped me. But then I think that when you look at some of my heroes, whether it's Cary Grant or Warren Beatty or Paul Newman, you know, I think they're much better actors than they ever got credit for.
And I've always wondered what it was like for somebody who had grown up being a Cary Grant fan to suddenly be in a movie with Cary Grant. It's really hard to separate the image that you've created from the real person.
Yeah, no, I knew Cary Grant. I met him in one of my favorite chapters to write is the chapter where I get to watch the very first time I'm ever on television with Cary Grant. I was trying to date his daughter unsuccessfully, as it turns out, and went to her house to watch it. And he says, "Young man, do you mind if I watch your little television show with you?" And I was like, "Hey, yeah, you crazy old man. Sure, I don't care." I mean, I literally had no idea who Cary Grant was. I was so young and callow. And then, of course, many years later, I realized, you know, wow, what an amazing experience it was.
Well, I can sympathize with your plight about looks, but I'm on radio, so I don't have to deal with those sorts of things.
And by the way, for the listeners out here, this man is gorgeous.
Do you think that you have landed roles in movies and television simply because you're good-looking without consideration about your acting abilities?
No. I think that the cast – it affecting me one way or the other in terms of casting positively ended years ago. Here's the thing. Nobody's ever going to pat me on the back or give me any satisfaction or sympathy for being good looking. So at the end of the day, you just take it as it comes. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people say, "Oh, he could never play a cop. Oh, he could never play an astronaut. Oh, no, he could." There's the list of things I can't play is shockingly long. It's all good. And in fact, on The West Wing, one of the things that I so admired Sorkin for was they never played to, you know, the traditional leading man with me. They made me the nerd.
Well, they really cast against type, yeah. which is part of what made that show so wonderful.
Right.
But you know, a lot of people also complain about the paparazzi and the intrusiveness. And you even write in your book about when your grandmother was in the hospital and a nurse barged in looking for you to get your autographs. You know, people want the nurses to come in and take care of them.
No, my grandmother, and I tell this story in the book about, you know, my grandmother who I loved, and I flew to Ohio to be with her when she passed away. And she passes away, and I'm crying, and the nurse comes in to unplug her and prepare her to be moved. And she reaches over her body with an autograph and a pen and asks for my autograph. And I thought, wow, this is fame. Here it is.
My guest is Rob Lowe, who's written, it says here, an autobiography called Stories.
And I'll never call it a memoir again. Thank you for the catch.
It's published by Henry Holt. You started off with a sitcom, and now you're in Parks and Recreation. On NBC with Amy Poehler, Rashida Jones, and Aziz Ansari. Ansari. So is this your first sitcom since
beginning? It is, I guess. Yeah, I hadn't even really done that math, but you're right. This is my grand return.
But were you cast in this role because you're from Ohio?
Exactly. Well, I do know more about Indiana, where the show takes place, than anybody actually on the show, and have spent more time there. So I think they definitely picked my brain about that.
We have a clip from your co-star, Amy Poehler. I'd like to play a little bit.
Oh, great.
I'll tell you, Rob Lowe is a superhuman, but I do think it would be hard for him to do two shows at once. I think that would be hard to do. So, yeah. But he is a – let's not forget how handsome he is. Let's never forget that. Make that the headline.
She's referring to rumors that you might take over the role that Charlie Sheen had on Two and a Half Men.
Right, right. Yeah, no.
Any truth to those rumors?
Well, I actually did do three shows at once last year. I did Brothers and Sisters, Parks and Recreation, and Californication, and sometimes all in the same week. So I'm done doing three at once. I'm done doing two at once. I'm only going to do one at once, and that's Parks and Recreation.
Is it get confusing?
Yeah. Oh, no. Sometimes I wouldn't even know what set I was on. I would literally just
Who am I?
They would just roll me in like a wax figure, you know, pump me full of Starbucks and give me my dialogue.
Aren't you a friend of Charlie Sheen's? Were you surprised by the intensity of this meltdown?
I'm a longtime friend. And, you know, there's a whole section in the book about coming to Malibu and moving in next door to the Sheen family at 13 years old and trick-or-treating with them. And they were my childhood friends. So
you went to school with his brother.
Went to school.
Worked with his father later in the West Wing.
Absolutely. So, I mean, our lives are very enmeshed over the course of decades. So I come to this with a sort of different perspective. And I love Charlie, and I'm crossing my fingers for him.
Well, you've had problems with various substances. Do you think that he can cure himself without going through AA or some kind of therapy?
Listen, I will have 21 years sober this week. And if I've learned anything is that there is a program out there that works if you are willing to work at it. It worked for me. And Charlie and I argue about this. We're still in touch. We argue about it. He has zero interest, hates it, thinks it's bad and whatever he thinks. And we agree to disagree. But I do know that nobody can change their life unless they're ready to do. I mean, when I came in, when I got sober, if they told me to stand on my head in the corner, literally, if they said to do it, I was ready to do it. And that's where you have to be.
Because you realized it was ruining your life?
I knew that I just was done. You know, I was just done. I was done living that life. I wanted other things. I wanted more than anything to try to have stable, long-term relationships. And, you know, today, you know, I'm blessed to have my wife and my two boys. And, you know, it's not perfect. Nothing is. But I'm happy as a clam. And I don't have any of it without, you know, changing my life.
A lot of people get involved with substance abuse because they're self-medicating.
Yeah.
And people always wonder, how can that happen with a movie star who has it all?
Right. Well,
you're dating the most beautiful women in the world. You're getting all the roles you want.
I have a. There's a phrase for that, It's called the Peggy Lee syndrome. And what the Peggy Lee syndrome is you strive and strive and strive for to be famous or to be successful or to have all the girls or whatever your goals are. It could be in business. It could be to sell your company, to be a Fortune 500 CEO. Whatever it is, you get to your goal and then you realize it doesn't change you on the inside. And then the Peggy Lee song, Is That All There Is, starts to play in your head. And that's when you really get loaded. So it doesn't surprise me at all to see people at their height spiral. Because if you're looking for something outside to fix you on the inside, you're screwed.
And how did that affect the way your career and the way you were living your life at the time? Were you aware that you were in pretty bad shape for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I was one of those guys who I looked at myself as old school, kind of like rough and tumble after rap or getting off stage. And, you know, it's a grand tradition in show business. And by the way, a good one, a fun one. But eventually I couldn't sustain it and it started to affect my relationships. And like I said, you know, I spent my 20s following fun. And then I spent my 30s. Or actually, from my mid-20s on, sort of building my life.
Well, you were a nerd who suddenly was famous.
Yeah, I was the nerd on the quad who couldn't get anybody to look at him, and suddenly I'm famous.
Well, I don't know how to ask you this question, but I've always wondered why people agree to tape their sexual activities.
Well, first of all, I think I was the first, and I think I do need some sort of a license fee.
Just on all those other people.
I just want a license fee on the Kardashian tape because then I can afford – I can stop doing television because I'll be rich and I can go to the theater where they don't pay me and really follow my dreams.
Yeah, you should have patented the idea. Where did you meet your wife?
I met her on a blind date and it was great. We liked each other but didn't really totally click. And then –
But she must have known who you were.
Yes, half blind date.
There's that inequity, isn't
it's
there?
Totally, it's totally – yeah, as I say, it's not a blind date. I keep saying this is not true. Come on. It's blind on my part.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought she was great. And then I did a movie called Bad Influence, and she was the makeup artist and a very, very talented one. And that was really the beginning of our relationship.
And obviously, you thought she was better than, for you anyway, than Melissa Gilbert or Princess Stephanie of Monaco. And it's led to a stable relationship.
Yeah, we'll be married 20 years in July. And because I look at it this way, I did a lot of research. I did a lot of R&D on this project. And when I found the right one, I was smart enough to jump at it. And, you know, she's my best friend. She's the one I want in my foxhole. And she's incredibly sexy. And turns out, great mother. So I'm like the luckiest idiot that ever was.
Edith Piaf wrote sang a song called, in English, I Regret Nothing.
Yeah, sure.
Do you feel the same way? Or
absolutely.
Are you looking back at the career, are there things you wish hadn't happened?
No. I feel a tremendous satisfaction of 3 decades of being relevant. And just to remain relevant, just to remain in the conversation is huge satisfaction for me. And then at this point in my life to have a book, which is a whole new direction for me as a writer, and to have the kind of acceptance that it's had from literary circles. Forget sales. But to have the sort of critical embrace of this new passion for me 30 years in is what you dream of.
Well, this is not an as-told-to book. You wrote the thing.
I wrote it all longhand on legal pads, actually.
And is this – had you written all along or is this something you discovered was of interest to you as you your life was evolving?
I started writing out of self-protection. I started rewriting my own dialogue on various projects if I didn't feel it was good enough. And
did the scriptwriters appreciate that?
Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But most of the times they did, actually. I found them to, everybody to be really pretty gracious. Not on everything, but on some.
Well, as long as you don't come across as a diva, it looks like you're just trying to improve the
situation. Which is exactly what it is. And by the way, usually I'm cutting my lines. I'm one of the few actors that usually is like wanting to say less, because it's better to say less if it's not great than more. I started the writing then, and then, you know, my mom was an English teacher and a lover of letters, and gave me that gift.
Isn't there a book coming out this fall about parks and recreation?
I think that there is. I think there's a book.
Will you be writing some of that?
They asked me to write for that when I was writing on deadline for this book, so I did not get to write for the Parks and Recreation book.
But I suspect the way you're talking now, you want to write again.
Yes, indeed, I do. This experience has been everything I could have ever hoped for and more. Because here's the thing. If I have ever suffered in the sort of public perception business, it's because people didn't know me. And now, for better or for worse, they know me. This book is of me.
Just one more thing, and very quickly. Most actors want to become directors. You want to be a writer?
I know. I'm looking for I'm looking for jobs that pay me less and less and less. That's
coming
my motto.
To public radio. Alec Baldwin's making the move. You can join him.
Exactly.
Rob Lowe's book is called Stories I Only Tell My Friends. It is published by Henry Holt. And Rob, it's been a lot of fun talking with
you. Thank you.